Art and Cultural Heritage Law in Ireland and Beyond. Hello, I'm Richard Harwood, I'm a barrister at 39 Essex Chambers.
And I'm Clarissa Levy, Art and Heritage Counsel at Wedlake Bell.
And we are delighted to have with us Martin Bradley. Martin is a barrister in Ireland and a qualified archivist with over 25 years' experience working in the art and cultural heritage sector. He's the author of a new book, Art and Cultural Heritage Law, A Practical Guide, focused on the law in Ireland, but brings in international law and cases in other jurisdictions, including England and the United States of America. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Richard. Hi, Clarissa.
So, Martin, why did you write the book?
I think predominantly because I hadn't really realised that the practice area existed in Ireland when I was qualifying as a barrister. And I suppose after I qualified, I was casting around a little bit to see if I could find a way to combine my experience that I'd gained working with galleries, libraries, archives and museums for a couple of decades at that point with my legal qualifications. And actually, I stumbled upon the Diploma in Art Law and Ethics at the Institute of Art and Law in London, which I completed that diploma. And it was kind of an hallelujah moment for me because I realized that there was this whole practice area that I hadn't really realized existed before. And to some extent, a lot of people didn't really acknowledge it existed in Ireland as a practice area at all. So I suppose what I wanted to do was write a book which defined what the practice area was, with a view to people, I suppose, within the legal profession here, understanding it as a practice area. And I don't know if it's a direct result of the book, but the Bar of Ireland has now recognised art and cultural heritage law as a distinct practice area. I suppose the other reason I wanted to write the book was, you know, the clue's in the title, it's a practical guide. So I wanted something that would be accessible to people who worked in the GLAM sector, to maybe help them answer some initial questions, but also, I suppose, for fellow lawyers who had an interest in all things art and cultural heritage and wanted to get to grips with the basics of how the law and those areas intersect.
It's a subject which has really only been recognised as a separate practice within England and Wales within the last sort of 30 years through the work of people like Norman Palmer in the Institute of Art and Law, who's brought it together. And what elements has your book put into that topic?
I was thinking about that issue, and I suppose I made a note of an answer I received from somebody who had actually asked why it wasn't viewed as a practice area in Ireland, which I thought summarised almost why it is. And the response was that it was not a consolidated and unified legal area. It involves numerous disciplines of law, such as intellectual property, contract law, constitutional law, tort, tax, commercial and international law, criminal litigation, import and export law, and many other things. And I think that's probably a good description of some of the range of what I've tried to do in the book.
Yeah, I think it's that sense of a legal sector in the way which we have energy law, which goes from commercial to public law and criminal law coming into it. Environmental law has got a whole series of disciplines. In sports law is a great one for lots of different aspects, but there's still a coherent subject matter. And there are, as people are coming at it from different directions, there's lots of common issues and a lot of people involved who are dealing with it in a multifaceted way, which is, I think the book does a brilliant job of pulling that together. And there are relatively few books in any of the jurisdictions which actually have managed to bring art and cultural property law within one set of covers.
Thank you. It's very kind of you.
And I think something that does come over in the book is that you're pulling in the international treaties and also a lot of the case law and legislation in the UK jurisdictions and USA and other jurisdictions. So it's a book which I think is immensely useful as a practitioner in a variety of the UK jurisdictions. But I think it's a book of interest to people who are dealing with art law well beyond Ireland in terms of the topics it covers, both directly on their law, but also inevitably by analogy that comes in.
I suppose when I was writing it, even if you set out to write a book on something like art and cultural heritage law as it applies to one jurisdiction, you will inevitably be drawn into international law and international treaties because of the nature of the art and cultural heritage market, and I suppose the origin of pieces of art, items of cultural heritage, things that are on display in museums, and without getting into too much detail, obviously, things like the various scandals in the British Museum and obviously Nazi expropriated art, these kinds of areas are governed by international laws, treaties, and protocols. So it would be impossible really to talk about just art and cultural heritage.
One thing the book does do is to include case studies, which sort of tell some of the stories. And I think it'd be useful to talk about some of the, particularly the Irish-related cases, which you mention. So first of all, the Irish experience in relation to treasure, how's that worked?
I suppose I talk about the case study, as you mentioned, in the book in relation to the Derry na Flann hoard, and Webb and Ireland is the famous case in relation to looking at the issue of treasure trove in Irish law. The first question was really whether the common law principle of treasure trove survived Irish independence in 1922. Common law, I suppose, is distinct from statute law, as you know. In Ireland, pre-1922 statutes remained in force and pretty much until they were repealed. There were a number of repeal acts in 1962, 83, 2005, and then there was one in 2007, which basically specifically repealed all statutes unless it was specified as having been retained. But obviously, that doesn't help with the issue with common law or royal prerogative. I suppose most of your listeners would be familiar with treasure trove, which is effectively, it's a common law prerogative which existed in the UK prior to being repealed by the Treasure Act in 1996. And effectively what it relates to is concealed items. It normally relates more to hoards than individual items, because individual items can be accidentally dropped. The idea with a hoard is that it has been deliberately placed somewhere with the animus revocandi, in other words, the intention to come back and reclaim it. And also within the UK concept of treasury trove, there were various rulings in relation to the percentage of gold and silver that needs to be contained in it in order for it to be considered treasure. And broadly, if it met those requirements and was declared treasure trove by a coroner and a museum wanted to take it into its collections, there was an award paid to the finder, or if the museum didn't want it, it was returned to the finder. The concealment issue was important, obviously, in cases like Sutton Hoo, the ship burial, so that was found not to be treasure trove, because by definition, a grave is not intended to be reopened. So this brings us to the Webb. So the two men by the name of Michael Webb Sr. and Michael Webb Jr. discovered the Derry na Flann hoard in 1980, which was just a significant hoard, including a chalice and various other items of significant early Irish and Viking significance. They found it with a metal detector, and it was found in an area that was subject to a preservation order under the National Monuments Act of 1930, and there was a notice on the site saying as much. The Webbs had no express permission from the landowners to excavate. When they found the items, they actually sent them into the National Museum of Ireland, along with a letter from their solicitor saying that they wanted the museum to hold on to the items until the legal ownership of the hoard was determined, and this will be significant later. The Webbs were offered £10,000 by the state. They rejected the offer. They asked for the material to be returned. The state then informed the Webbs that the state were the owners of the hoard, and in parallel bought out the rights of the two landowners for £25,000 each. The Webbs then brought a case for detinue, basically saying that a bailment had been formed with the state when they gave it to the National Museum. This was subsequently overturned at appeal on the basis of the letter from their solicitor, which they had given the material to the museum pending a determination of legal ownership, so they had not asserted any rights to it, so therefore a bailment couldn't have been formed. The case went the whole way to the Supreme Court, and basically the famous judgment by the Chief Justice Finlay, who basically said that no, treasure trove had not been carried forward under either the 1922 or 1937 constitution. However, the state had firstly acquired good title from the landowners, but also secondly, and importantly, under Article 10.1 of the Irish Constitution, all royalties and franchises within the jurisdiction belong to the state. And Chief Justice Finlay looked at the meaning of the word royalty and basically said that a necessary ingredient of the sovereignty of the state is the ownership of objects which constitute antiquities of importance which have no known owner. This entire area was tightened up by the National Monuments Act in 1994, which says that no person shall have in his possession or control an archaeological object found in the state. So basically what that means is all archaeological objects found in the state are vested in the state.
I think what was seemed to be interesting about the judgment of the court was that it wasn't following on from the rights of kings to items of treasure. but I followed it, an assertion by the state of ownership of important items which were found, and as you say, had no other owner, that nobody knew that they owned them, as a recognition of a heritage right that is of a public importance and so is then vested in the state.
Yep, I think that's a correct and fair summation, yeah, in that the heritage objects, archaeological objects, form part of the sovereignty of the state itself, and ownership of those objects must be vested in the state on that basis. I think it's worth saying as well also that the state did pay the Webbs. So they want to share a sort of a £50,000 reward between them, which was entirely discretionary.
It's in everyone's interest. And I think you make this point, Martin, that it's in everyone's interest for the state to be the owner and look after these things, because they're for all of us and they're vital to all of us. So you don't just want one person making off with something that's important to everyone. And the only way to ensure that that's going to happen is for finders to be fairly rewarded.
And there's also there's the balance between discouraging people from concealing finds and enforcement of the statute that prevents them from doing so. So in other words, the pursuit of criminal remedies, it's kind of the carrot and the stick approach. And really, from the state's perspective, what it is looking for as an end result is ownership of those items and custody of those items in order that they can be preserved and then enjoyed by the citizens.
Another one I wanted to look at was the approach to the underwater heritage island. Of course, is Ireland. It has a sort of major shipping lanes past it and quite a few wrecks in that process. So you cover some of the situations there. How's Ireland dealt with that sort of picking up the wreckage of, in some sense, other nation ships?
I mean, it's fair to say that this one is complicated, and I'm not an expert on maritime law, but I will try to answer that. There are a couple of issues at work here. So obviously there are territorial waters, which extend, I believe it's 12 miles from the coastline. And then there's the exclusive economic zone, which is the continental shelf, which for Ireland, the continental shelf stretches a huge distance towards North America. So Ireland's exclusive economic zone is very significant. I mean, I suppose if I talk about maybe the example in the book, that would be a solid way of getting into it. So there was an American exploration and salvage company called Odyssey Marine, who in 2011 found the wreck of a ship called the SS Gersoppe, which had been torpedoed in 1941. And on board that was £150 million worth of silver. Now, that had been torpedoed in international waters. The ownership of the ship rested with the British state, and Odyssey Marine concluded a contract with the British state in which to salvage the material, and they split the proceeds. The same company subsequently found another ship called the SS Mantola, which had been sunk in 1917, carrying 600,000 ounces of silver bullion. So again, a really significant amount of money involved. And that ship was found 25 miles west of the Blasket Islands, which are off the southwest coast of Ireland, off Kerry, outside Irish territorial waters, but within Ireland's exclusive economic zone. So under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, Article 56, states have sovereign rights within their exclusive economic zones for exploring or exploiting natural resources. But what this statement doesn't say is anything about shipwrecks. So Odyssey Marine relied on the fact that there was nothing specific about shipwrecks to say that by surveying and looking for shipwrecks, they were not actually in contravention of Article 56. Under Irish law, the National Monuments Act defines what a wreck is. It's more or less what you'd expect. It's like, it's a sunken ship, it's underwater. There's nothing about the age of the ship in that definition. Under Article 3 of the National Monuments Act, 3.1, there's a mechanism for placing something called an underwater heritage order on a wreck within either territorial waters or the exclusive economic zone. So basically, if the Irish government knows that there is a significant wreck anywhere within the EEZ, it can place an underwater heritage order on it, which basically precludes people from tampering with, exploring, removing items from the wreck. Article 3.4 of the same thing defines a wreck as something that's more than 100 years old. So nothing that's over 100 years old can be tampered with. So this is where the issue with the Mantola kind of fell between two stools, because it was torpedoed in 1917. It was found in 2015, so it was less than 100 years old. So it didn't meet the requirement for being automatically precluded from being tampered with. It was also outside of Irish territorial wardges. So at the time, the approach of the state was explained that it was not using the mechanism which allowed it to place an underwater heritage order on wrecks in its exclusive economic zone, because it was waiting for the publication of the UNESCO Convention on the Protection of Underwater Heritage, which came out in 2003. Now, of course, when that did come out, that convention defines a wreck as something that's over 100 years old. So this doesn't, again, address the sort of the lacuna between things which are more or less than 100 years old. There's also the issue that at the time of writing, neither Ireland, the UK, nor the US have ratified the UNESCO Treaty on Protection of Underwater Heritage. So basically, Britain and the US still exert their rights over wartime shipping that belonged to them that was sunk. The end of the story was quite interesting because Odyssey Marine then moved towards beginning salvage works on this ship, but their contracts with the British government lapsed in 2015, and they were obviously trying to complete the salvage before the 100-year period occurred, which is in 2017. And then the end of the story was that, and I quote, an unspecified entity salvaged the ship under contract with the British government. It placed the contents of the wreck with the receiver of wreck in the UK and split the proceeds with the British government. And Odyssey Marine tried to bring an action in Wren against the ship to find out who had actually salvaged it, but they were unsuccessful. So yeah, it's an interesting story, but it all hinges on the definition of a wreck and this issue around 100 years old territorial waters and the exclusive economic zone, as well as who exerts ownership over the wrecks.
Well, I love the way in the book you've illustrated, as you say, with these case studies, fascinating stories which make the explanations of the tax very much more palatable and digestible than otherwise they would be if you were just talking about plain old tax. Which brings us, I hope, to the story. Can we talk about the guitar now?
You can, of course.
Marvellous. I'm very excited about this guitar. So Rory Gallagher's Stratocaster, Fender Stratocaster, which is discussed in the book, you know, and you talk about the tax planning which could be possible around the Strat and what actually was done. So what's the story? What happened with the Strat?
For anybody who's not familiar with Rory Gallagher, he was an incredibly influential Irish blues musician, widely regarded as one of the best in the world. After Brian Jones died, he was offered the job in the Rolling Stones, but turned it down, and Mick Taylor subsequently took that job. He formed his own group, Taste. They played at the Isle of Wight Festival, very successful as a solo artist, until he died very prematurely in 1995. He was only 47 years old. From that period onwards, his brother was his manager and also took custody of his large collection of guitars. And basically, you know, there was a charitable foundation to advance the causes that Rory was interested in. In 2024, it was announced that the guitar was going to be auctioned by Bonhams in London. There was a value of between €800,000 and €1.2 million placed on the guitar, which at the time people thought was probably a little on the low side if you got the right people who were interested in buying it. But it became something that became a cause célèbre in Ireland. So the Lord Mayor of Cork was calling for the guitar to be kept, and kept on Lee side, the River Lee going through Cork. Obviously, Rory Gallagher, even though he was from Donegal, was very closely associated with Cork. The tornister at the time, Micheál Martin, stated that he was very interested in keeping the guitar in Ireland and hinted that some negotiations were going on behind the scenes involving the Minister for Culture, Arts, Tourism, Heritage and Gaeltacht. Around the same time, another famous guitarist called Joe Bonamassa, I don't know if you've come across him, American blues guitarist, famous for being a huge collector of vintage instruments, and I suppose one of the people that might possibly have been lined up as a purchaser. Other people being suggested were people like Brian May from Queen, who's a big fan of Rory Gallagher. But Joe Bonamassa was on the radio and basically said, look, this guitar should stay in Ireland. It's a key part of Irish heritage, and effectively looked like he was discouraging people from bidding on it and said that he wouldn't be bidding on it. The guitar eventually went to auction. Really interesting auction. Actually, I watched the whole thing through, and some huge sale prices for things that I wouldn't have thought would have huge sale prices, like a wheeled flight case with Rory Gallagher written on it, sold for £1,000. But the guitar was obviously the star of the show. But as it transpired, there were only two bids. And it was announced afterwards that the guitar had been purchased by, I think it's Gaiety Live Productions Limited, which is one of the companies which is owned by Dennis Desmond, who owns MCD, and MCD is the largest concert promoter in Ireland. So what appears to have occurred is that there were negotiations behind the scenes, certainly that's what Micheál Martin was alluding to, and that an agreement was arrived at whereby Dennis Edmund would purchase the guitar and then donate it via Section 1003 of the Taxes Consolidation Act 1997.
What does it mean? What is the tax that's going on here? I mean, or might have been, because I presume we don't know the exact details.
So Section 1003, the way it operates is it allows people to donate items of specific artistic or cultural significance.
Like guitars.
Now, obviously, I talk a little bit about this in the book as to whether a guitar could be deemed an artistic or cultural artifact. But in order to make a donation under this section, first of all, the donation needs to be approved by the Council of National Cultural Institutions. So they have to agree that it's significant enough to be acquired. It's got to be worth at least 150,000 euro. And yeah, it has to be an outstanding example of an object in its kind. I believe that it's a similar requirement in the UK. And the way that it works is basically the person who's donating it values it, the state values it. Whichever of those two values is the lesser, you get an 80% of that valuation as a tax break.
No matter what tax is in point here?
It can be applied to capital gains tax, capital acquisitions tax. It can also be applied to income tax and can be extended among family members.
So all those taxes are all coming in at different rates. And yet, with a donation of a preeminent guitar, you're going to be given a tax credit of 80% of the value of the guitar, no matter what. That's nice and simple, isn't it? Really beautifully straightforward, and I love it.
And I guess the great advantage to the state is that it allows the state to acquire things at a 20% haircut.
Fantastic. And so it's not a comparison between the tax incentives for heritage guitars in England versus tax incentives for heritage guitars in Ireland. But that is a very different scenario to what might happen elsewhere. The rules in Ireland have come about just from thinking through from first principles, as far as I understand. Is that right? They're not based on anything else. They haven't been inherited from anywhere.
No, my understanding is that these were brought in 1997.
Brilliant. So that is why they're nice and straightforward. If we were drawing up new tax rules from scratch, that's what we might get to.
You sound like you're frustrated that this may not be the case with the ones that you're dealing with.
I'm actually a fanatic. I'm far from frustrated. I love it all. I love all of this. Any method that helps states to acquire important guitars, I am in favour. I mean, I thought it was just really beautifully explained in your book, nice and simple. And so what's going to happen to the guitar now?
So it's actually being taken in by the National Museum of Ireland, which is one of the things I was quite pleased with myself in the book, because that was actually my prediction for the auction, that that would be what happened. And the reason why I predicted that was the National Museum had previously hosted an exhibition called Rock Chic, which had exhibited various guitars, including this one. Whether it's displayed in the National Museum is another question. I suspect there will be a lot of pressure from the Cork contingent for it to be displayed in Cork, but we shall see what happens.
Maybe even played once in a while. Anyway, I vote for a field trip.
It would be nice to see it played. It'll be interesting to see what that changeover is like, because obviously in the run-up to the auction, they had various musicians playing it. So they had Carlos from Fontaines DC sitting around strumming it and chucking it around a little bit.
Cool stuff. Yeah, exactly. Because it's a living instrument. I mean, musical instruments are.
This is the thing. And then you do wonder whether it's going to end up with people with white gloves putting it in cases with thermohydrographs and monitoring the lux it's exposed to, which I guess, obviously, it's part of their duty of care, given that this instrument is interesting because of its sort of famously battered appearance.
I must say, I am interested, though, in the whole concept of heritage objects and cultural property continuing to be handled and used and lived with. And it's certainly in England, it's part of the expectation that objects which are, for example, exempted from, say, inheritance tax can, and indeed it's envisaged that they should carry on being used for the purpose they exist for. So musical instruments can continue to be played within reason.
Is that when they're left in, I suppose, the custody of the owner rather than being transferred to an institution?
Well, it could be either. Although I think institutions would have more difficulty actually finding a way to make that work. But in theory, it could be either.
Yeah, interesting.
But anyway, yes, a very interesting and illuminating kind of example of the tax rules. And as we know, as we're constantly saying on this podcast, it does all come down to tax.
For the final topic I wanted to come to was the Irish approach to export of items of great cultural significance to Ireland. And do you want to take us through how that's been dealt with?
Yeah, I might go with the story approach again. And this is a case study that does appear in the book, and it really relates to Pádraig Pearse's surrender letter. So Pearse was a barrister. He was the founder of St. Enda's School in Dublin, which was a school which sort of promoted strong cultural nationalism, Irish language. And he was a key figure in the Irish Republican Brotherhood, who were a faction within the Irish Volunteers. So the Irish Volunteers formed as a reaction to the formation of the Volunteers in Northern Ireland, which formed as a result of moves towards home rule. Pearse was involved within the faction of the Volunteers who staged the Easter Rising in Dublin in 1916. Pearse occupied the GPO, the General Post Office. After roughly a week of fighting, rebels were obviously hopelessly outgunned by the British Army, who brought in reinforcements. And they eventually surrendered at the end of April in 1916. Actually, on this point, I mean, you may have seen, I don't know if you've seen the famous photograph of Pearse giving his surrender, where he's kind of wearing a slouch hat and a long coat outside the sort of the rubble on O'Connell Street. But one of the people in the background in that picture is the author Neville Shute, who would be familiar to your Australian listeners. He's the man who wrote On the Beach and Town Like Alice. So Pearse surrendered. Him and a number of the other leaders of the Rising were subsequently executed by a firing squad after a very rushed court-martial. And this was one of the things that was instrumental in swinging Irish public opinion towards the nationalist movement. Before his execution, before the court-martial, Pearse wrote letters from his prison cell in Arbour Hill, basically telling the various garrisons around Dublin to lay down their arms. So one of these letters kind of made it into the news around 2016. So it was being put up for sale by a private seller. They exhibited it in the museum in the GPO with a view to drumming up interest in it. The suggested auction price was 1 to 1.5 million euro because it was the centenary, 2016, 100 years old, the Easter Rising. Various overtures had been made to the state to buy it, which they had turned down on the basis that they had several other of these letters that Pearse had sent to other garrisons, and also because of the high price that was put on it. Subsequently, it went to auction. It was withdrawn at less than the price that the buyer had purchased it for. There were suggestions that the person who was selling the letter might avail of Section 1003, which we spoke about just now in relation to Rory Keller. Unfortunately, he had no business interests in the state. So I think he may have been an American gentleman. So he had basically no tax liabilities against which to set it off. So this was of no use to him. So he then basically sought an export license to bring it out of the stores, having withdrawn it from auction, which brings us into how export licenses in Ireland work. Most of the regulations around export control are contained in the National Cultural Institutions Act, and they relate to things which have been held in various scheduled institutions for set periods of time, whether that be 5 years or 10 years. It also designates various types of items, so you know, documents, paintings, archaeological items that require license in order to be exported. Now, the issue is that it specifically states that an export license must be granted unless one of the exceptions apply. And the exceptions are that the item has been in the custodianship of one of these scheduled institutions. There's also an exception for archaeological objects. But as we've already seen, all archaeological objects belong to the state, and it's actually specifically precluded from anybody to have in their possession an archaeological object. So that's not an issue. What happened in the case of the Pearse letter was that the minister at the time entered it on the Register of Cultural Objects. So the Register of Cultural Objects, again, is defined under the National Cultural Institutions Act. What it is a register of objects whose export from the state would constitute a loss to Irish cultural identity, words to that effect. But being placed on the register doesn't stop it from being exported, nor does it allow the minister to prevent it from being exported. All the minister was able to do was put a 12-month delay on the export. Now, what was suggested at the time was that by choosing the route of putting it on this register of important objects and by delaying the export license, the state was hoping that somebody would come forward. So in other words, as in the case of the Rory Gallagher guitar, a business person would come forward, would purchase it, and would then maybe avail of the tax breaks. This ended up not happening. The letter left the state. Nobody knows where it is now.
So it's just a regime rather like the UK regime of the Waverley criteria being applied and a stop being put, but only a temporary stop to give an opportunity to somebody to come forward as a purchaser rather than process of saying that certain items just cannot be allowed to leave.
As I said, there are archaeological objects. There is the capacity for the minister to deny export license for those. But I suppose the balance that has to be met is where the desire of the state to prevent the export of an item rubs up against constitutional rights to property for things which are in private ownership.
Perhaps just one sort of final topic to cover, which is this question of what in Ireland are seen as important to Irish heritage, being conscious of the fact that for a large part of Ireland's history, it's been under a form of British governorship and for a period being part of the United Kingdom before independence. So what in Ireland is seen as being important in heritage terms, given its history?
There are almost two questions there. I mean, if I suppose I might start by just addressing the first one, which is what is seen as being important for Irish heritage and art and culture. And obviously I cannot speak for the Irish state nor its people, but I'll try and explain my understanding of it. I mean, obviously Ireland has a very long history in relation to art and placing value on art. I mean, as I talk about in the book, the world's first copyright action was recorded in Ireland in the 6th century when King Diarmaid ruled on the copying of a Bible in a dispute between St. Columba and St. Finian, and his ruling was to every cow its calf, to every book its copy. Ireland obviously has a really long monastic tradition, so a long written tradition, a long tradition of illustration and artwork. It's got a very long oral history tradition. In terms of literature, Ireland has four Nobel laureates, Heaney, Yeats, Beckett and Shaw. The first Olympic medal that Ireland won was for painting. So Jack B. Yeats won the silver medal for painting in the 1924 Paris Olympics for a painting called Liffey Swim. Obviously, you've got the development of a lot of arts and crafts movement as part of the kind of the national cultural independence movement that grew up in the sort of late 19th, early 20th century. Significant figures like Harry Clarke, stained glass artists, the Cooler Press, which was run by the Yeats sisters. But there's also things like intangible cultural heritage. So Ireland's a signatory to the 2003 UNESCO Convention on Safeguarding Intangible Cultural Heritage. And inscribed in Ireland's register are things as diverse as Uilleann piping, the construction of dry stone walls, the sport hurling. These are all parts of Irish culture and identity. And I guess probably the most important expression of Irish culture and identity is the Irish language itself. As the saying goes, Tírgan Teanga, Tírgan Anam. Country without a language is a country without a soul. The second part of your question kind of relates to Ireland's intersection with empire and being part of the United Kingdom for a long period of time. So obviously Ireland was part of the British Empire, for better or worse, until independence in 1922. Ireland had a huge history of working in administration in the colonies. I believe the figure was that in 1860, something like 40% of the British Army was made up of Irish recruits. And these regiments were very commonly sent to India, South Africa, colonial conflicts. To give you an example, like my grandfather was from Derry, he was a Catholic nationalist. He served in the British Army in the First World War. His father, my great-grandfather, served in the British Army in the Boer War, but he was also an Irish Catholic nationalist. He was a Derry City alderman who attended the talks in relation to Irish partition in 1922. So there's a long history of involvement on both sides, I suppose, of the community with the British Army and working within the civil service and colonial administration. And as a result of that, there are quite large collections of those sorts of ethnographic materials that have been sent back by these people to Irish museums. Famously, Sir Roger Casement, who had been sent by the British government to look into the Belgian atrocities in the Congo, sent back a lot of material to the National Museum of Ireland. And I suppose the Irish approach to how that material was dealt with changed after 1922. I mean, I might just read a paragraph really quickly following the establishment of the Irish Free State in 1922, a movement to accumulate, preserve, and display such objects as may serve to increase and define the knowledge of Irish civilizations, of the national history of Ireland, resulted in ethnographic and colonial exhibits being de-emphasized. So what you see in Irish cultural institutions is large collections that were built up over that colonial period, but which tend not to be exhibited. So they pose a problem for the institutions. They take up space. They're not being exhibited. They're not being accessed terribly frequently. So the approach of the state has been, in 2023, an expert committee on restitution and repatriation of cultural heritage was set up. And that contains representatives from all of the national cultural institutions, as well as representatives from the legal sector and people with expertise in ethnography, anthropology. And it's chaired by Sir Donald Deeney. So that body will be issuing some guidelines, following on from which I suspect we will see some movement in relation to questions of deaccession, restitution, repatriation of those items.
Martin, thank you very much. The book is an absolute tour de force in terms of covering the scope. And I think we've touched on, I hope, enough to give listeners an idea of some of the reach of the book in the discussion which we've had. Said, I think it's a book of great use to lawyers and practitioners in many jurisdictions on the art and cultural property side. And thank you so much for coming to talk about it with us today.
Yes, thank you, Martin.
Thank you both. And thank you for the kind words. It's been a great pleasure coming on here today and chatting with you both.
Thank you for listening to the Art and Heritage Law Contested Heritage. Please do follow or subscribe on Apple or Spotify podcasts to enjoy more shows.
We have a new podcast out every fortnight. If you're able, please take the time to rate us and put down a review.
The show is also on the 39 Essex Chambers website, along with podcast series on topics such as artificial intelligence, climate change, and planning.